Hey, before we get to the episode, I just want to let you know that I will be teaching my Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive here in Chicago in person on the weekend of August 6th and 7th. You'll learn the Artist Low Comedy Improv Method in only one weekend. The Artist Low Comedy is about slowing your improv down so it becomes as easy as having a conversation. You get out of your head and into your heart. If you want a new approach to improv and you want to do improv scenes that matter, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and sign up now. I limit this to 10 people. And if you sign up before July 9th, you'll save $30 on this workshop. That's jimmycorain.com. And if you can't make it to Chicago, don't worry. I will be offering an intro to the Artist Low Comedy online on July 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. I limit this to 10 people so you get personal attention. And the workshop, if you sign up before July 13th, is only $49. Go to my website, jimmycorain.com, for more information. And to register, that's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Welcome, everybody. Come on in. Turn up your headset. Turn on your whatever you're listening to, your device, whatever your device is. Maybe you're listening to this on a phone. I don't know. I don't care. Just come on in. Take a seat. We have another great episode of Improv Nerd. I am the host of Improv Nerd. My name is Jimmy Corain, if you don't know that. We have a great episode for you today. Our guest today is Kelly Semmelsberger. She has been improvising, teaching, and directing live improv for the last 26 years. She started out in Chicago back in the 90s, where a lot of great people started out, including myself. That's where I met Kelly. And then she moved to Charlotte in 2001 to start the Charlotte Comedy Theater. She is the author of her new book, Improv Shaman, The Transformative Journey of Divine Play. We talked to her about realizing you're enough when you're on stage, how to take care of yourself, and how that affects you on stage. And she gives us an exercise to be more vulnerable in our improv. Before we get to that episode, it's great to be back. I know I've taken a little time off, but I'm here, okay? And you don't have to give me any shit for it. I'm giving myself plenty of shit. I just want to say something. Recently, I went and I looked on Apple. You know, that's where the you can get this podcast, one of the places you can get this podcast. And there were some really nice reviews, and I'm not going to read them to you. But I just want to take this opportunity, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, and I'm asking you as a friend, I guess, this is kind of a favor. If you are enjoying what we're doing, to just go to Apple and then just write us a nice review. I would really appreciate it, because It makes me feel good. It really does. But you know, I have low self-esteem, so it doesn't take much in the outer world to make me feel good in the inside world. So enough about me. Here it is, the Kelly Semmelsberger episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Kelly Semmelsberger, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'm so excited.
I am too. Let's talk about the 90s. You're living in North Carolina. You're married. You're a mom. You're a corporate trainer. You have a house in the suburbs. How do you end up leaving all of that and doing improv in Chicago?
Well, that's a really good question. There's so many answers to that. I think part of it is it was so confusing for me at the time. I just knew I wasn't where I was supposed to be. I had worked so hard to have that life. I came from such a broken home. And so to cultivate this life where I was a professional and I was a mom and married and I had the nice new home and I had the new car and I'd worked so hard to get the American dream. And I was so miserable. I was so depressed. I tried everything. I was working out. I was going to therapy. I was going, you know, I could not understand that this was not for me. And eventually just got to be, you know, you get in so much pain sometimes, and it doesn't even have to be physical pain. But when I think Well, I believe that if you are not on your soul path, your heart will betray you. And no matter how good what you're doing looks to the outside world, you on the inside know that it's not the right path for you. And I think that's where like kind of the imposter syndrome comes from a lot with people. Maybe it's not that you don't think you're good enough or good at what you do, but maybe you're not on your right path and something feels disingenuous about that. So I think I had a lot of that. And I just made the decision that I didn't want to be miserable and in pain anymore. So, and then Chicago just came to me. Like I'll go to Chicago. I mean, my mom was there, but we didn't have a relationship. So I was like, okay.
And so, and you talk about in the book, Finding Your Tribe, how was it coming to Chicago in the '90s that you realized that the improvisers are your tribe?
You know, I had never done theater performance or anything before. It was never anything in my realm. Now I was the person that would, you know, crack up and do that kind of stuff with my friends. I would do the weird daring things, but it wasn't until I'd been there almost a year and I was doing more corporate training, but I would get so nervous. And I thought, well, I'm in the home of improv. Why don't I just take an improv class and maybe I'll get better at my vocation and can move up the ranks. You know, I still had that corporate mindset. And as soon as I started taking my first improv class and meeting improvisers, I was like, oh, these people get me. Like as weird. And, you know, I say things that other people are thinking, but you're not supposed to say, I say them anyway, you know, that people are like, oh, yay, you're good for that. Instead of, you know, telling me to be quiet and keep my head down. There was a place that lifted me up. And then I think the first time I ever saw the Lost Yetis, remember next door to IO, when it was still at that bar before the Clark Street IO was IO,
and you saw the group, the Lost Yetis, which was a Herald team, which was really yes. great. Bob Dassey was on that and Stephanie Weir. It was just really
Stephanie Weir, Seamus. There's so many
Seamus McCarthy, yeah.
Chicago improvisers. And I remember them doing a scene where they're in the chairs and they were doing a scene as they were in motorcycles and throwing things back and forth and moving the chairs as motorcycles. And the give and take was beautiful. And I remember just looking and say, that's what I want to do. That right there. And to that level. And then it never stopped. It was just something that I was like, that is beautiful. And I want that magic.
And then you threw yourself in, you studied at the Improv Olympic and as, cause we crossed paths a little in the '90s, I have to say you probably were probably the only single mother doing improv. And I'm really curious to know what was that like?
It was challenging, but at the same time, you know, Colby, I'm actually at her house right now. She was raised in the community. I don't think anybody else knew what to do with us either. Del called me the one with the kid.
How old was Colby at the time?
Six when I started, seven before she really started coming around. And there were times, you know, and Sharon was gracious with her. So was Mick, like everywhere I took her. Cause there were times I couldn't be at rehearsal. Cause I didn't have a babysitter and people were like, yeah, come on anyway. And there were times, I don't know if you were there when she became props on stage, you know, we used her as a prop and also put her in some shows, but, the community really didn't know what to do with Colby, but at the same time, we're so beautiful and honoring of her as a child, because all of us were recapturing our being a child. So it was a safe, beautiful place for her to be. You know, Shara tells a story about the first time she met Colby. She walks into her own theater and there's this little girl working her box office with Stuart Ranson, who was on my first team. And she was like, she goes, who are you? And she's like, what theater are you looking for? And she started directing Sharon as to where to go for what show. And she was like, oh my gosh, you know? So the community was beautiful with her. So she actually loves telling the stories about being raised in the theater. And of course, people that she hung out with have gone on to be famous and write things that she's so proud of. And so it was interesting. It was hard financially, but at the same time, it was a beautiful thing. She had a childhood no one else would ever have. Very unique.
What's one of your fondest memories about that time in the 90s in Chicago, either on stage or just hanging out?
All right, let me tell you, a lot of it's a blur because it was Chicago in the 90s. So,
well, you allude in your book that like me, you were doing there was a fair amount of drinking going on.
Oh, yeah. It's a fair amount of drinking and smoking and other things that took from my practice, from my spiritual and improv practice. You know, I think I couldn't you know, give you one specific memory, because I have so many amazing memories. I mean, it was so many years of my life there. But what I think is, it was the Haight Ashbury of improv time and space. I think some of the most incredible talent came out of that. And you can see now in what's happening either on film and TV shows, who's writing and doing everything. They're in comedy. It's a lot of the Chicago 90s improvisers. I was very blessed. I think we all were to be there in that time. There still were enough of us to feel the vibe of what was going on, but not so many of us. We didn't know each other. Like, you know, we could go to any of the parties or go to any of the theaters and you know everybody. You know, you'd go over to see people at Second City that were in your shows or that were your cast, and we all kind of moved back and forth. It was very much still a small community. And I think that's what I remember most, is like, it's a place that taught me that I had a place of belonging. And all my memories were really of community, of just such a beautiful community we had. And it wasn't until much later that I would call that tribe, that I would understand that as being a tribe. But I think, I mean, I just have so many beautiful memories of all the people that I got to play with and work with and party with and, you know, cry with. But that we did have this community that was so close. That's my overall favorite memory. The rest of my probably can't say in public.
And then eventually you move to North Carolina and you start a theater in a school there. What were the lessons that you learned in Chicago that you brought to Charlotte?
You know, so much besides obviously technique, all that always, will always apply similarly, but it is such a different marketplace. One of the things I learned was you can't act like you're in Chicago and Charlotte. You can't act like you're in Chicago anywhere. It's a whole different level of play. It's a different expectation. It's a different audience expectation. What I learned was to stay adaptable. And what I learned was I learned some things from Chicago that I didn't want to do in Charlotte. In Chicago, because it is an actor's town, it is someplace that's a little bit more competitive. I wanted to have more of that kind of, what I loved about the clubhouse feel at IO, I wanted to expand upon that, or even at the Annoyance, I wanted to expand upon that and make it even more so this safe place, because that's what really improv gave me, was a safe place to be and explore and be myself and to welcome others of all different types. So I think I learned that I wanted to create something that got rid of kind of the competition aspect or the feeling like you're in high school and there were these levels or to feel like you had to audition to get to the next level. I wanted that gone. So I really learned from the Chicago stuff what I didn't want and also what I did want, so I could kind of cultivate my own thing and not make it like, you know, a repeat of anything that existed in Chicago, but take the elements that were beautiful and really focus on those. Because no matter what you're teaching improv skills, that's always going to be consistent. But what is the environment that you want? And that's the thing I really focused on, was having a healthy, healthy environment where I taught.
And let's talk a little about your book, Improv Shaman. Do you take some very familiar improv terms and kind of discuss them in the book? And there's concepts and themes that run through it. And one theme I think is, to me, is finding your voice, or you say being more vulnerable, being more authentic. How do you do that in a group?
Oh, that's a very good question. It's there's so many ways. And I guess it would depend on whatever group we're talking about. You know, there are some places that you can, well, I'll say how I do it, especially with like new students, for instance. I got a room full of new students and they're terrified and I'm the instructor. So I'm already in this power position to them. I come in and carry this space of acceptance just with me. And I also love to do exercises about just like kind of calling on all of our humanity and how we're alike. My exercise will always start off with, you know, what are things that are bothering you right now? And then going around, I'm like, what are things that you want to say you're going to create in your life? And then really getting to human stuff right away. I don't go around and ask people like, what do you do for a living? And what do you want to get out of this class? Because we all hate that. I immediately talk about those things. I also created exercises like, you think that's bad? Which is where we all give up our most embarrassing moments and we go around the circle and compete as to who's been more embarrassed in public.
Things so how would that game work?
The game of you think that's bad?
So I would say, like, I split my pants on stage because I weighed 280 pounds. You think that's bad. And then.
Right. And then I would say, you think that's bad. I drank too much the night before and had seafood and had an explosive episode at a CarMax while shopping for my daughter's car. You know,
Think that's bad. You know, my family wouldn't let me speak at my dad's funeral.
That's then I want to hug you. And that's what happens. So we all go, you think that's bad. But then you have the moments where, like, oh, because then it'll go. We'll share more and more. You think that's bad. I was married 2 times and neither time could I have children. I only have children out of wedlock.
You think that's bad. I had my first, my only child at 52.
You think
so
that's
we would
bad.
Go around like that. It probably in a circle, I would imagine, right?
Or people can volunteer because some people may not be ready to share. And I never put pressure on anybody because the next time we play it or something else, they may be willing to at that point. It's really, I also give so much room for comfort level when I teach because really, and it's just the way I raise my kids. I'm not trying to raise a successful child as far as like, make sure you have a good, you know, you make this much money and have a 401k. I want them to like themselves. I want them to love themselves because a person who loves themselves loves the world and takes care of it and takes care of themselves, right? So I want my students to feel safe above all else. I want them to feel comfortable and that they belong more than anything else. Anybody can teach skills and some people can, it may or may not get the skills based on what they're capable of doing, but to feel safe and comfortable is key to me. And then I'm setting the garden. I'm putting in the fertilizer for all the rest of the growth. But yeah, I think that's very necessary. So like, games like that I'd like to play because it's fun. Everybody laughs. And then, you know, each other as human beings. I also started a warm up just happened oddly where, I had people go around and introduce themselves in a new environment and then give everybody a compliment. And then I'd stop them really shortly and say, wasn't that awful? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, did you compliment everybody on their hair or their clothes? They're like, yes. I said, okay. See how.
So how would that game work? We'd be in a circle.
So okay. So we'll do the first part of it. And I'll tell you the cool. Well, then we can do the second part of it. Okay. It's like, if I'm forced to now introduce myself to you, like, I don't know you. So Jimmy, nice to meet you. I'm Kelly, and I love your glasses. They really look good on you.
Thank you. And I'm Jimmy. Do I introduce myself to you?
Yes.
I'm Jimmy, and I really like your glasses, too.
Thank you. So now we have both complimented each other at a very superficial level, which is I will bring up and say that's what the world has taught us to think of each other. And as much as we feel comfortable with, like, anything more is very difficult. So now I change it to something that's totally different from that. I'll say, okay, let's introduce each other. Like, we will endow each other with some sort of amazing thing about the last time we met. We know each other and somehow you have stuck with me because of this thing. So I could do it with you now. It's like, Jimmy, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing you right now. Like, the last time I saw you is when you flipped the car off of me and drug me to the hospital over your shoulder. I can't even thank you enough. You are real. I just thought you were an angel.
Oh my God, Kelly. It's so great to see you. The last time I saw you, it was there was 10,000 people in the audience and you gave this TED Talk. And I've listened to TED Talks, but that TED Talk really, really inspired me and changed my life.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. I couldn't do that TED Talk if it wasn't for you saving my life.
Well, I mean, you've saved my life twice, you know, and compared to, thank you. I just want to thank you.
Let's send each other gifts, shall we? Yeah.
Yes. So the part where I get the compliment part, the part where we then do like a made up thing, like we just did the TED Talk and me taking the car off you. What is that? What does that accomplish?
I think and also later on, I'll go to a step where once they're more comfortable, we'll do it again. And I'll add the step of now compliment the person as you know them to be later on. In the
okay,
class.
Great. So how would that?
So I see the bridge is missing here, but I don't do that for a couple more weeks. Then I'll do bridge. Like every time I'm around you, you light up a room, you know, they can start going to greater experiences. So I kind of jumped them to the fun. Like, isn't it more fun now? I'm going to remember you as the person who saved me. And you're going to remember me as the TED Talks person. And then we've already formed this kind of magical pretend bond, which is really what improv is all about, is we make up these stories and we give it to that cast, that other person. And now we're doing it purposely as an introduction. And I alluded to, when we do scenes, we're doing the same thing. We're giving these stories to our scene partner and delighting in it and accepting it and moving forward. So it's kind of like, even in the introduction, this is the first time I teach them, just in play and in their nervousness, to go ahead and endow each other with things, and then to take that on and to like let go of who they feel they're responsible to introduce themselves as. You know, if I come in as like, I'm Kelly Selmsberg and I run Charlotte Comedy Theater, it all feels awkward and strange. So we go into the pretend world and take that awkwardness away. And then a week or two later, we'll go into, here's how you impact me, like kind of on a more real level. So we've
got to know each other in class. And, you know, I really like playing with you because you agree a lot on stage, or I really feel supported up there because you go with everything I give you.
Yeah. I love being on stage with you because you make eye contact with me right away. And I have a feeling that I can move on the moment I see you on stage.
Oh, I love you on stage because you play so real and it just is so comfortable. There's another thing you talk about in the book, and it's kind of repeated too. And that is taking care of yourself as an improviser. And I think if you were in Chicago in the 90s, that wasn't a lesson that we learned necessarily. So how does taking care of yourself, and if you, before I ask this next question, what does taking care of yourself mean off stage for an improviser?
Oh, that can go to, you know, the basics of self-care, you know, honoring your body, knowing when you're tired, knowing when you need food, knowing when you're being too hard on yourself, when you're sick. You know, it's moved a lot. You know, we've learned so much through COVID, and still to this day, there's a lot of messages I'm giving my students and my cast about self-care, because it's changed, because it's so much more dynamic now. You know, our mental health self-care has come into play and in conversations. Self-care about knowing when something's kind of off boundaries for you or triggering for you. There was no concept or talk about triggering. You played with whoever you played with and they treated you the way they treated you, especially as a female or a person of color or a BIPOC person. You didn't get to say, that really just, that did not feel good to me. You know, so self-care as a person is knowing your boundaries in the outside world and being able to, your physical, emotional, spiritual boundaries in the outside world, and setting those and sticking with those. And then also having those on stage if you need to have those on stage, and us all honoring that for each other. There are a lot of people that have said, I'm sorry, I couldn't come to class or whatever. I was sad and depressed and blah, blah, blah. I said, you do what you need to do to take care of you. But I will tell you, some of my most sad, depressed days, I showed up anyway. You can sit in the back and roll on the floor if you want, but feel free to come and not feel like you have to give anything to this theater, to this class. You can just be here and receive from us. And that's a lot of messages people don't get, that it's okay to receive and just be in the environment, not feel like you have to be on or not give. But sometimes taking care of yourself is just being around people that inspire you and not being required to do anything for that.
Well, that also speaks of another theme in your book, and that is you're enough.
Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to the first thing you asked me. It's like, or early on, you said, how did this feel like your tribe? Is that when I started improvising, and whether it was on stage and I had a crappy show or just hanging out, I felt like I was enough in this environment. Improvisers build on what is. So since we build in what is, whoever comes to me as a student or who I came in as a student was enough. And then we take whoever Kelly was or Kelly is now, and I get to build on that in every moment, in every scene, or I can just be something else entirely. But who you are is enough. The experience you have, as I say, is I luckily have all, like right now, Jimmy, I have all of your experience to my disposal. I don't have to have your life or live it in order to have that. I'm grateful for that. You don't want to live mine either to have that experience. So I think a lot of that, you know, goes back to this community. And why I wrote the book is I think this community is a very special community. I think it's a very sacred community to me. The only other time I felt like part of a team was in the military. And that was a whole different thing that we were trying to accomplish. But you have that leave no person behind. I've got your back. You know, the mentality of like, we make each other look good. it's just not found anywhere else on such a broad scale as this work. And I think it is so beautiful and so sacred. And I think it is so healing. And I wish, you know, we could teach it to, you know, Congress and the Senate. I wish it was more broad of this mentality that we have. And that's the enoughness. That's the building on whatever is, instead of tearing down each other or creating that enoughness and that not enoughness, which everything else in our society does, including teachers, you know, are being graded from a young age, you know, A, B, C, D, it tells you where you are, even if you may be neurodivergent or may have other learning abilities. So yeah, I think this work and the people who do it are all about making people feel enough and part of. Yeah.
Is there an exercise that you do that makes people, besides your attitude about it, that brings home that point that you're enough?
You know, one I use a lot, which is such a simple one, and I know everybody, every improv teacher knows this one, is the Oracle, or Dr. Know-It-All. I just like the Oracle. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's where everybody gets to just say one word and then build each other's.
Right. So it'd be like if we were an expert on dating, we each take one word, like a one word sentence. So if I ask the question to the Oracle or Dr. Know-It-All, what's the best place to go on a first date? We would say, I
think
that
you
should
go
to
Starbucks.
Okay. So how does that accomplish
when you do it enough? And you, of course, you have to talk it down. You can't just do that and go, oh, now you all feel like you're enough.
Right.
I wish it was that instant, because we'd be doing that for therapy all the time.
Right. I would feel enough, because I've done it plenty of times. You
know? Well, I think it's going, our not enoughness is based on our own expectation. We have to handle the whole thing, right? The whole piece of this answer. Because I'll ask things like, when should children be spayed? Why are women better drivers than men? I ask questions that people are going to have an attitude. They're going to have a thing about, and they're going to want to finish the whole thing. They're going to have the answer. They want to be right. And then we do it enough times. As like, didn't you see how fun that was? It didn't have to be right. It didn't have to have one opinion to it. And you didn't have to take on the whole thing, which means the little bit that you contribute to whatever you are giving, your piece of energy, right now it's just one word, but in your workday, it might be this product or this project. With your kids, it might be reading this book. But that one thing is what you contribute to the energy of your life. And that is enough, because other people build on the rest. You are not the only person creating a happy home. You're not the only person, event, or thing creating an effective and good work life. You are not. You only have this little piece. And if you can remember that part of your life is just one word, it's just the right now, being in love with what's in front of you right now, and serving that moment and serving with all that you have right now, that's your one word. Because that exercise breaks it down. You can only listen, pay attention to what's going on around you, and give your thing. And sometimes it's very limited what we can give. I mean, right now we know we feel pretty powerless in a lot of ways, but what can I do right now? You know, like in the social political aspect, I can give money to the ACLU right now. That's the love that I can offer.
Well, the other thing you talk about in your book is being in the moment, and really improv to me, I don't care what you're teaching, what kind of style, it all comes down to being in the moment.
Yes.
And you talk about in your book, four things that get in the way of being in the moment. Can you talk about that for us?
So I kind of, when I do this in front of a class, I will stand and go, imagine me in a circle. And if I stand to the left, this is me judging others. They're not good enough. They're too good. They're so good. I can't be good. I can't shine because they shine. Anything. This is standing outside the circle. Then I'll go to the right of the circle. I say, this is me judging myself. I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm too fat. I'm too whatever we want to hurt ourselves with. There's also in the past, thinking in the past. So I'll step backwards and say, if I step in the past, I'm not really reliving the past, but I can bring a trauma to where I'm feeling right now something from the past, because I'm thinking about it in this moment. It's not happening to me now, but I'm experiencing this moment, this fear of failure, for instance. Or I can be step in the front and say, or I can be in the future going, man, I hope this teacher really thinks I'm good and I get to be on a team. I hope that you know, I marry somebody worthy of me or anything. And you can bring those emotional expectations to the present moment. But then I step back in the circle and I said, no matter what you're doing, really, this is the only time that exists. You will feel everything right now. You can't feel anything in the past. It's gone. You can remember when you felt it. Can't feel anything in the future. It's not there. And that judgment is going to push you in or out of your body. But right now, if you give all your time, energy, emotion, and passion to loving, and I do say loving this moment, even sometimes when they're hard moments, because if you love it, you're going to go through it with a kind of compassion to get through it and to serve it. Sometimes we have to serve and be there for things that we don't enjoy. You know, like recently I've been sick. I didn't enjoy it at all, but I had to serve that moment, and that had to have my love and my focus and attention. And that's that being in the moment. So yeah. So the past and the present don't really exist. It's only what you feel about them now. Right. Which we love to conjure, to do great improv scenes. Right. To bring that energy and that emotion, whatever you're feeling right now, so everybody can feel it. And judging yourself just pulls you out because you're thinking about performance generally, right? Theirs or yours. And I don't just mean on stage. I mean, our performance as a human being and where we're supposed to be, you know. Dell actually, in one of his classes, I remember him saying, he telling the story about how he woke up from a dream. And this is one of the things I will always remember. He said, I woke up from a dream. And the thing was, in the dream, I was flying and I was like pedaling in the air to keep myself flying. And then the farther I got away from Chicago, the more I couldn't tell where I was. I couldn't see the buildings anymore. I couldn't tell the landmarks. All I knew is that I had to keep going to stay afloat, but I couldn't see landmarks to see what my progress was anymore. And to me, that was such a great metaphor about life, is that, you know, when you're really flying, you don't have any landmarks. You're out on your own. I mean, there's not something saying you're doing good. We have these ideas that if you graduate college, you're doing good. If you get married, you're doing, you know, like there's these small landmarks that our society has, but when you're flying, you're going past those. And then you just have to keep going. Just keep going. You're not going to have anything to tell you that you're doing a good job anymore. But you're flying. You know, I think that's what living is. You're still here. We're still kicking. Nothing's going to tell you you're doing a good job. You just got to feel it and keep going. You know,
well, so what do you tell improvisers? Yes. Because I think a lot of improvisers fall into this trap that if they don't make a team or they get cut from a team, that they're not making progress.
I think that's the delivery of it as well. I mean, you know, of course we've had that in our space too. And we generally, you know, as a principal, we'll offer to supportive, because to me, I feel like if they didn't get there, it's my job to get in there. I am their teacher, or this is our training center. So we offer like putting them back in other places or working with a different instructor, or, you know, but there's sometimes when people can't, it's up to the instructor or training institution to say, you know, you have gotten a lot out of this. You've gotten what this is going to be for you to serve you. There are other things evidently that you still will want to work on, that you want to go forward with, but we got you here. You know, what else do you feel like you need to do or need to accomplish? Not everybody's going to be an improviser. Not everybody can let that go on stage. And that's usually the thing that I see holding people back, is they're still trying to protect themselves when they're on stage. And I recently started saying, you know, when you walk on stage, you're stepping into a storybook. Get in there, you know, step fully into it. Really enjoy the magic of this moment. You've been taking classes, you've gone to rehearsals. Today you showered, you reserved time, you brought friends to come to this show. When you step on that stage, and as soon as you hear something that starts creating the world that you're living in, step fully into it, enjoy it, and embrace it, and take this time to really play. Because you have, our shows are an hour and a half. You have an hour and a half of your week or month, however often you play, to really immerse yourself into this beautiful, pretend magical space that we've all created. Do it, enjoy it. And then everybody lights up and they're a lot more like, yes, let's play.
And what you're saying is, and it's something that I struggle as a performer, and I think I'm eventually getting better as a teacher, is focusing on the positive stuff that you're doing.
Yeah. And there are some people that, you know, every once in a while you're going to have, you know, a train wreck student that literally is like, this is probably a mental health issue, not an improv issue. You know, I can only do what I can do. I'm an improv teacher, you know. Or generally, I'll say, you know, I think that there's other things in your path for you. And improv has served you as much as it can. And and you have something, if you continue to do this, you're not going to be spending your time and money on whatever it is you should be doing. But I think you should investigate that, because this has served you as much as it can. And you've gone as far as you can in this, and you've done a great job, because this was a big thing for you to take on. And for everybody, it is. Everybody is a level one student, you know, shaking in weird, not knowing what we're going to do. And halfway through, I was just like, thank you for letting me, you know, trusting me enough to do these weird exercises we have them do. You know, I've got them doing, and every once in a while I'll say, I understand while you're doing like, say, Monster Machine, Slow-Mo Riot or something. I'm like, I know you have a degree and you're wondering what's happened to your life, that this is what you're doing right now, but trust me, you know. Yeah, it is the positive. What is going right?
Well, I think improvisers have a tendency to beat themselves up. You know, I didn't do this right. And what I'm learning is like, that doesn't really make people better.
No, it's the same thing, you know, as your life path. I say this, you're not doing it right compared to who. If there was somebody living your exact life from your same parents, same genetic code, right next to you, that's got a better credit score than you, then you might could judge yourself. But there's nobody ever living your experience. Nobody is doing this scene for you in this moment right now with whatever you have on your mind, or whatever the scene partner gave you, or whether you're too hot or thought you had to pee, whatever. That moment is gone. And it's so unique to you that moment even happened. Let it go, move on. You know, we do say, I'm not where I should be. And I hear that a lot, especially at our age. You know, I don't have a lot of money put away or whatever. I'm just going to trust I'll be all right. But the thing is, nobody's ever been Kelly Semmelsberger before. You know, I'm charting new territory. I'm learning about it all the time, you know, and sometimes much to my dismay. But I say that too about scenes. Like, the great thing about our art is it goes away. You know, once that scene's over, the only reason it's still there is because you are now in the past holding the memory of a scene that didn't work out, instead of getting back and giving all your love to this moment, which is now a new scene, or you have to edit for the next scene. But we need you present now. Let that go. It's gone. And nobody else is going to remember it but you.
Well, you bring up an interesting point that I think I struggle with and improvisers struggle with is, let's say you go out and you, in your head, right? You make a mistake. Mm-hmm. Maybe you deny, or you walk through an object or something like that. And now you're beating yourself up, right? Because you feel you screwed up. How do you let go of that and then go back to the moment and the love you talk about?
That is a conscious effort. It's no different than realizing that your self-talk is like abusive. And every time you have these thoughts, you're like, wow, why am I so mean at myself? You know, I dropped something. I called myself stupid in my head, you know, that you start monitoring the thoughts that happen in your head, and you go that and start changing those thoughts. And I think most people have had to go through that, is really seeing how you're treating yourself and talking to yourself. And that's that same voice that says you screwed that scene up. Even though, you know, technically you may have screwed the scene up, we all know as improvisers, there's no screwing up a scene. We can make fun of the fact you, and this is why I tell people as students, we time travel. So you could have thought you messed up that scene. Let's say it was the second scene and you denied that person, or you walked through an object. Five scenes later, we could refer to that, make it hilarious, and make a callback to it that will make it funny, that will give it new meaning, that'll give it depth. You don't know what you're doing in this moment, how it's going to serve you later. So how do you know it was a failure? You know, me having children out of wedlock probably at that time seemed like could have been a great failure for me. I wouldn't have changed that for the world. There's a lot of things I think we've all had happen where we're like, oh, I wish I had gotten that job. You find out later the best thing that happened, you didn't get that job. Or we think we failed or made a mistake in life, and it ended up being the thing that served us most to be the more happy, authentic person. Same thing with a scene. You can't value that scene while you're in it, or when you just got done with it. You have no idea the context of that scene, because it's part of a whole. Just like any decision you make is part of the whole story of your life. So it really is just that one word. So I get out of it by going, I can't judge that right now. Right now, I've got to give my love to what's happening now, which is I'm beating myself up. Okay, stop that. What's happening around me? And that's one way to get back to center. It's a way that people also stop having panic attacks, is what is around me? Oh, I'm in the middle of a live show right now. my job is to make my scene partners look good. And now I'm focusing on me and my bad thing instead of them being on stage that may need an edit or walk on or to be left alone. But that's up to me to focus on them, which is, this is the energy of what's happening. And I think that's back to loving the moment. Is you catch yourself, you love yourself in that moment and go, oh, I'm beating myself up. Wait a minute, let me get back to the base. So it's a practice and a choice to get back to center, to go, hey, in this moment, where do I need to be?
Well, it's interesting how you describe it, because it's almost like an out-of-body experience, like someone would experience trauma. And what you're saying is get grounded, you know, look around, feel your feet on the floor, take a deep breath, you know, get back center. And is that...
That's true. We've all been traumatized, whether it's, you know, really horrible traumas, but we all have. We're all walking around like, you know, that's why this is like, I consider this a medicine. And it's great medicine for that. It brings you back to center. It also brings you in service of others. You know, we take care of each other. And to go, oh, it's not just about me and what I think about myself. And guess what? All those people in the audience are not thinking about you. They're thinking about where they're having a good time and laughing. And I even remind my players, I said, you're in service, because those people for an hour and a half aren't going to worry about their bullshit job or the horrible things going on in their life. You are going to take them on a magical journey. And that's the beauty of how you're serving in this world. And we're having a good time with our friends, you know?
So what do you mean, when you tell people you're in service, what does that mean? Service to the audience, service to the players?
Service, I think, to all. Including the audience, because in that moment, it's not about, and this is where I think a lot of performers may get it wrong or may find themselves getting nervous. And this is what helped me, because I had a terrible stage fright, is I'm here to offer a view of my life and my creativity and that of my teams and everything we've been working on and how we can communicate together out of nothing. I'm offering that to people who have never seen that kind of thing happen, or rarely. Or it only happens in this environment. I'm offering that to you to see that human beings can work together and adults can play and all the beautiful things of improv. I'm offering to that. I'm giving my energy of that to my art, to the audience. The audience doesn't owe me anything by coming. It's not their job to laugh at me or feed me energy. And luckily they do most of the time. And it's reciprocal, because so it's an energy exchange between us and the audience. That's why we like doing live stuff, and being on Zoom the whole time was not wonderful. We didn't get the same exchange, but we have to remember it starts with us coming out and giving it to the audience. They're not knowing what's going on. I liken this when I teach people how to host, is I say, imagine you're bringing people into your house, and you know them, but they bring friends with them and boyfriends and girlfriends you don't know. And you're showing them around. You're like, this cooler has beer. This has non-alcoholic stuff. Here's where the bathrooms are. Wiggle the hall bathroom if you flush it. So when you have a show, you're showing people around your house. You're showing people, this is what we work on. This is how we play. This is how we create. This is how we process what's going on in the world in our time, is through the vehicle of improvisation. And we're going to give that to you. And then they're like, yay. And they give that back to us. But if we start out wanting the audience to approve of us, that's a different power dynamic. And then you are already in a powerless seat.
Well, it's almost a spiritual principle you're talking about. If you want the love back, if you want the response back, you need to give it first.
Right. And I think so many of us go around the world wanting it to fulfill us. And it's what I call, a different book I'm working on, is it's called The Difference Between Being an Inside Out Person and an Outside In Person. So if you are an outside in person, you are waiting for the outside world to fill you, which also means all the politics and drama and crazy stuff that are going on are really going to push you around. You're really going to be like, I can't function in the world because it's crazy. Well, yeah, it's crazy, but it doesn't have to destroy you, so you can function as a light within it. So the inside out people is like, I'm being grounded in myself and I'm here to give to this world. I was born, I'm going to die. And in the middle, my job is to give as much as I can to this world, in whatever way I can, in the way Kelly can, which is doing weird stuff on stage. I'm inside out. So I'm going to go affect the world instead of expecting it to take care of me.
Well, I think that speaks to another concept in your book, and that is not worrying about what other people think. Because if you're worried about, for me, it's always struggled outside validation. If I get fame, if I get on a sitcom, I'm going to be fine.
Yeah.
But to not compare or really worry about what other people think about you, How were you able to overcome that?
Well, you know, there are many students go, you know, Amy Poehler. I'm like, yeah, she's one of my teachers. She's like, well, how come you're not famous? I'm like, ooh, that's a slide.
Okay, two up.
Yeah, right. I'm like, ugh. Because I believe firmly, because I think if you really push being in your authentic space and doing what makes your heart sing, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. And I believe that each person comes with some energy they're supposed to give to the world. And like, Jimmy, you doing this podcast, it's you getting this information out to people. This is you doing in your skill set what you're supposed to do. And to me, what matters is not being famous, because I wouldn't want that. I don't want everybody knowing about the stupid things I do. I want to serve my community. I want to make wayward children like myself feel like they are loved and they have a place and they can come be themselves. And I've created that. And maybe not with intention at first. I'm sure not. I just needed people to play with. So I was mentally sane. I think if we really are following our heart and not what society tells us is valuable, but what is valuable to us, then we will find the thing in which we can serve and we will be happy. And that is success. It is absolute success. And I think because I lived a successful life and I was miserable, I know the difference now. I feel it in my body when I teach a class, when I'm running around on stage or even doing the stuff it takes to get on stage and vacuuming the theater, whatever. I feel that I am in service of this world the best way that I can be with my skills and even my brokenness and even my trauma, everything that is me, that is my experience, comes out in its fullest and best light through being an improviser, and I can't even say improv now, and a teacher, instead of what, you know, my friends are famous and I'm not, you know, that is, I'd love to have the money maybe, but it's not, they're doing what they're good at. They're doing what their calling is, or they wouldn't be there. I think we're all where we're supposed to be, as long as we don't feel that, you know, horrible feeling that we're not, you know what I mean? You're serving in the way that you're supposed to.
So we got to wrap this up. And before we end each episode, we always ask the same question. Let's see if I can remember it. And that is, what one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
I would say my most important advice would be kind of what we talked about today, is be kind to yourself and be around the people or the teachers or the institution that make you feel welcomed and safe to where you can learn, because that's the beginning of all of it. And feel free to play and explore. I know that there's absolutely, not just in improv, but in life, there really is no failure at all, is something in which to build upon and create more from. So be in that place of like love and co-creation, love yourself and the people around you, and just go for it.
Kelly Semmelsberger, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you so much. I loved it.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd. I'd like to thank our guest, Kelly Semmelsberger. She is the author of the new book, Improv Shaman, The Transformative Journey of Divine Play. I'd also like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Artist Low Comedy workshops and classes, both online and in person, and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, sign up for the Improv Nerd blog/newsletter. I write a blog probably almost every week, tips on improv, tips on life, insights about my life and how crazy I am. It's great to be on the mailing list. It also gives you information about my workshops and classes. So go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Like our Improv Nerd Facebook page. We're on all the social medias. We're on the Instagram and we're on the Twitter. So find us there. Also, I want to thank you very much for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. He's a nerd.